bit.ly/KBOO, or you can text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth, and have a good night.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. It's county budget time in Multnomah County, the first that Chair Jessica Vega Peterson has been fully in charge of since winning her seat. There are some important things included in this budget and some important things left out. The process is going by quickly. A final vote on the budget is scheduled for June 6th. Last Wednesday, May 8th, was the first public hearing on the 2025 county budget. Here's Vega Peterson opening the floor for public comment.
Tonight's budget hearing is one way that Multnomah County collects community feedback on our budget before it will be adopted on Thursday, June 6th, at the regular meeting of the Multnomah County Board of Commissioners. The FY25 executive budget is the first one I've had the privilege to lead from start to finish. It is an offering to our community and a reflection of where we're coming from, where we are, and where we're going. I am very proud of the values reflected in this budget.
One Multnomah County program that's been left out of this budget is the Multnomah Mothers Trust. It was a project started in 2021, offering unconditional cash transfers to African American mothers in the county. Payments of $500 started in May of 2022 to 100 Black mothers in need, but the latest county budget hasn't allocated for the program, meaning that as it stands, those payments, which were increased to $750 last summer, will end on July 1st. But let's back up a step. What is an unconditional cash transfer? It's a program that's aimed at reducing poverty by giving people money without any conditions on how it has to be used. At the Multnomah Mothers Trust, mothers in the program had the option to respond to a survey about how they used the money for an extra $50. The participants in the program weren't told how they had to spend the cash, and anecdotally, a lot of it was spent paying down debt or on basic needs. Many of the mothers in the program since 2022 have been able to create emergency funds or build their savings. Some have gone back to school, two were even able to purchase homes. I got the chance to speak with some of the mothers in the program about their experience in the trust and what it's meant to their lives. Loyalty Hustler is one of the mothers in the program. She says being a part of the Mothers Trust changed her life.
Being able to have the ability to not have to worry about whether or not if I can pay for my son to get his haircut or take it from my light bill money. So just kind of having that sense of alleviating that extra stress, being able to allow me to grow as an individual. You know, I've currently been in school and I've had to pick up extra shifts while I'm in school, which take time away from my studying. So it's allowed me to not have to strain myself more than I have to and work 10 times harder than I have to put my best foot forward to have the finances and also excel in school. So I've been able to chill on picking up overtime shifts and also being able to excel in my studies. So I'm grateful.
Keisha Kanda is another member of the trust. She says getting that $500 transfer meant a lot to her.
Being a single mother of three, living on one income, not having a partner, coming from domestic violence, don't have any child support, no food stamps, anything like that. So it was just my one income. And when it came in, I had a son who was going to a Catholic school, and so I had to pay scholarships for that as well. So it helped me a great deal just to be able to stay above the water, keep electricity, rent, and the bills, car insurance and things taken care of without having to let my kids know the stress that I'm really under. So it not only helped me financially, but it helped me mentally as well. It took the stress, like I said, off of me mentally of not having the money.
LaFonda Grant was also in the trust. For her, the unconditional cash transfer meant breaking bad cycles.
It helped me break barriers and fears. It helped me break the cycle of debt that I found myself trapped in. It provided me with the means to invest in myself and my family by establishing an emergency fund and significantly reducing my school debt burden. Yes. The assistance from the Mother's Trust Fund has enabled me to make sustainable life changes, boosting my inner self-esteem and providing me with the confidence to strive for more. I no longer live in constant fear of financial instability or wage garnishment. You know, garnishing my check, I have to pay my bills. And when garnishing your check, it throws you off. And with the with me not having to worry about that, the economic change period after COVID, you know, everything just went tripled. And I was stuck. I was like, what's going to happen? I can't afford this. Are we going to be homeless? I'm a mother of nine.
When it comes to the program being cut from the county budget, Hustler says it wasn't a shock to her.
Honestly, it wasn't surprising. And I just feel as being an African American in Portland, Oregon, everything has been taken from us. I'm pretty sure you may be aware of, you know, redlining and gentrification. And we don't even have a community we can call our own. So anything that is given or help us to succeed, it's never been something that stays. It's always taken from us, like life has always been taken from us.
What do you wish people knew about this program?
I wish people knew that it works, that women can grow from projects like this, that not just women, but all people can grow from projects like this. You know, I think our biggest worry is rent or the simple basic things in life. And if we just all was able to give this opportunity, the world would be a better place.
Candace says finding out the Multnomah Mothers Trust was being cut from the county budget in July hurt.
It hurt me because the people who are making the cuts aren't the people who are really living this life. So, you know, what do you say to a woman who's independent? Well, who became independent, got out of a terrible relationship that was, you know, detrimental to me, my children, my health, my mental. What do you say to a woman who is leaving a situation like that and don't get child support, don't get food stamps? You know, you cut something like that, to me it's devastating. Why are we cutting that? Let's not cut that. Let's find ways to maybe see where we can pull other money from and see how many other women we can help and put in this program.
Yes.
I mean, if you look at it, every woman that you will talk to from the Mother's Trust will have a story for you of empowerment, how it has impacted them a great deal. It's not, you know, the financial is amazing, but it's also about the mental and being a mother on your own and not having a lot and just being able to be blessed with that stipend every month to be able to just to continue to invest in your family. Yes, put a little money into savings. Yes, pay for your kids' schooling. I mean, kids are growing daily. They're growing daily. They have an appetite. So it's like the money is being spent the way it should be. It's like it's real. It's real out here. The money is being spent where it should be. And it was a blessing to be able to get it. I'm saddened because I want other women who are going through life like me, who are just trying to stay above water on their own, to be able to receive this help. It was amazing. And for it to end, I'm sad, but I'm very thankful and grateful to have received it.
Here's Grant again.
I wish they could feel the transformation like I did. And the experience with the support of the Mother's Trust Fund is a testament of the power and the impact of the community assistance. My journey from financial hardship to stability hopefully gives hope for other women who looks like me. Facing some of life's most difficult challenges, I would like to see the flame of hope with the Mother's Trust Fund ignite and continue to burn brightly, because we need this. Just that little bit of help goes a long way. A long way.
I just wish that anybody, before you make such a serious decision on cutting funds, that you maybe, you know, just come out of that office, come out of that chair one day and come down and meet the people that you are impacting.
Exactly.
Come meet them. Come see what their life is about. Come see the struggles that they go through. Come see the strides that we are making. Mm-hmm. Come see what we're actually doing. We you know, the women in the program, we're mighty. We're making moves, you know.
Yes.
Every woman that I know that has got this Mother's Trust
has excelled.
Like I said, we empower. We go down to the state capitol. We are trying to make changes for the women, our community, our children, you know, the people in front of us, the people behind us, on our sides, you know, everything. Mm-hmm. We got to realize and just try to do our best for the people who are going through it. You know, they're just as important as anybody else. And once we give them the opportunity to excel, they're going to excel. But you just have to put the power behind it. And with this fund being cut, it's just sad to me. Yeah. Nobody came down and asked. Nobody asked me how it's impacting me. Nobody asked me how amazing it was, what it did to me financially, mentally, and wholly for my family. Nobody. Mm-hmm. I just don't understand how something can be cut when you haven't even met the people that it has impacted. I don't understand it.
When early results of the program were reported back to the County Commission in November 2022, commissioners were enthusiastic about the results and what they reflected on the county. They even spoke about finding additional funding streams to support more mothers in the future. Commissioner Lori Stegman is quoted as saying, "I just want to say how proud I am of Multnomah County always being on the cutting edge of doing things outside the box. You are all perfect examples of that," end quote. The county commissioners will vote on the proposed Multnomah County budget on June 6th. The next public hearing on the budget is scheduled for Wednesday, May 15th at 6 p.m. On the chopping block is the Multnomah Mothers Trust, a program that gives 100 African American mothers in the county an unconditional cash transfer of $750 each month. I spoke with three mothers in the trust for this piece, Loyalty Hustler, LaFonda Grant, and Keisha Kanda. A screening of a documentary featuring some of the participants in the Multnomah Mothers Trust program called It's Basic will be shown at the Tomorrow Theater on Thursday, May 16th from 4 to 6 p.m. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings. You are listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm here with Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, to talk about their latest story. It's called If at First You Don't Succeed. City Council passes amended law seeking to jail and fine homeless Portlanders after court injunction halted 2023 version. Welcome to the show, Kay.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for taking the time to talk through your article with me. So it covers the latest so-called camping ban passed by the city on May 8th. Listeners may remember that we were here talking about a similar ban that Portland passed a little less than a year ago. What is important to know about this new ban?
This ban is kind of a continuation of that effort that had us talking about a ban last year. So the state passed a law that went into effect last July, which was what spurred the city to alter their current policies around public sleeping. The state law decided that any city ordinance governing what they described as survival activities. So, you know, kind of a sit, lie, sleep situation, cooking outdoors, things like that. Any law that governed that behavior had to be considered objectively reasonable. Last year, prior to the ordinance that they passed that ended up getting shut down in court, the city had a completely unenforceable ordinance on the books that outlawed public sleeping throughout the city. So they created that ordinance last year, which essentially did the same thing, though it was written in a way that was a little confusing, landed the city in court after they were sued over it, and it was ultimately shut down. This year's version of the public sleeping ban has a lot of similarities, though there are some differences. I think the big thing is that it still includes arresting, fining, and jailing homeless Portlanders, though that jail time has been reduced from 30 days in last year's ban to 7 days in this year's. So that is a difference, but they also eliminated the warnings that people would have received as it was written in last year's ordinance.
Are there differences when it comes to the types of, I suppose, conduct or behaviors that the city is trying to regulate between the old ban and the new ban?
Not practically. Last year's ban was commonly referred to as a, you know, daytime camping ban, though it didn't take long reading it to realize that it wasn't really all that specific to the day. It really was something that could have been applied just about at any time due to the place restrictions that existed in last year's ban that, it was this kind of very broad, vague list of where you could not sleep that if you were to read it and look at a map, you'd realize that it was just about the entire city. This year's ban is explicit in that public sleeping is banned throughout the city, though there are some conditions that, again, are essentially the same as last year for who the law is enforced against. Kind of the primary points of that being whether or not someone has the means to access alternative shelter or has been offered and rejected a shelter bed.
Well, you also mentioned in the article that City Council hasn't made any mention of when they would be enforcing this. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, there have been some not entirely descript statements that are, weeks ahead, months ahead, that sort of thing. But there's been no date for when they will begin enforcing it.
Right. Well, let's go to that new framing, I guess. There is this kind of interesting new way of phrasing what they're trying to get at in this law by creating a category of people who lack, quote unquote, reasonable alternative shelter. And you describe that as sort of the inverse of, quote unquote, involuntarily homeless. What are some of the attributes, I guess, of being somebody who lacks reasonable alternative shelter?
I mean, that's a very good question. I mean, the city has not really defined what it believes reasonable alternate shelter is. Per their kind of guidelines for who's subject to this law, it's people who have access to it or means to access it, or have been offered shelter and turned it down. It's essentially the same thing, but the city, like I said, has not really defined yet what it means by any of those things.
Well, and important to note as well, the ban adds that rejecting reasonable alternative shelter is now a punishable offense. What's the significance of that aspect?
Yeah, that's, I think, going to be, if I'm guessing here, albeit a fairly well-educated guess, what could be part of legal proceedings about this ordinance, which I expect it will end up at that point if the city tries to enforce it. Then we're getting into Martin v. Boise territory, which is a Ninth Circuit U.S. Court of Appeals ruling that prohibits cities from fining and jailing people for sleeping outside when that city does not have enough shelter beds. What this ordinance appears to do is create what I refer to in the story as a shelter or arrest ultimatum, right? You're creating this thing under the ordinance where if a police officer or social worker offers someone shelter and they reject it, under the ordinance, they can then be arrested. So there are a few considerations with that. And really the big one that I talk about in the story is that it appears the city's understanding of Martin v. Boise is different from legal experts that we've spoken to. The city, again, they're not offering a ton of clarity, but the way that it's written, they appear to believe that Martin v. Boise holds that if they offer someone shelter and they turn it down, then they can be arrested. What we've heard from experts is that Martin v. Boise doesn't contain this kind of one-to-one, like, we offered someone shelter, they turned it down, therefore we could have provided shelter. It's more of a larger consideration that takes into account the number of people who don't have shelter and the number of shelter beds in the city. And you know, to avoid getting too much into the weeds, it's really about status versus conduct, which is at the core of Grants Pass versus Johnson, which is currently in front of the Supreme Court. Martin v. Boise essentially found that for homeless people who do not have access to shelter, not right now, but, you know, broadly speaking, if they don't have, like, adequate, consistent access to shelter, then that doesn't change their status as a homeless person. Therefore, sleeping outside is not a voluntary choice. It's not conduct. It is part of their status as a homeless person. And currently, federal law prohibits people from being punished for a status. So that's kind of one of the larger, I think, differences in how the city appears to be proceeding and how legal experts think an ordinance could feasibly stand up to the legal test.
Well, I appreciate the explanation, and it is so easy to get into the weeds, especially when it is something that is kind of untested like this. And right, this ban loops in a lot of other bodies aside from Portland and its police. It also includes roles for the Multnomah County District Attorney and the Joint Office of Homeless Services. Now, you reached out to the DA's office. What is their role supposed to be under the new ban, and how have they been responding to this passing?
Their role is essentially what it was last year, and that was another issue that Street Roots reported on. We actually published a letter that the DA wrote to Wheeler, which essentially said we're not service providers, right? Because that is what the ordinance asks the DA to do, encourages the DA to do, which is rather than pursue charges against people who are arrested under the ordinance, the DA is instead supposed to or encouraged to connect them with housing or other services. Last year, the DA's argument was, hey, that's not our job. We don't have funding for that. It's the county prosecutor's office. They're not a social service organization. This year, they have been less critical. And I will say that they refused to answer whether or not Wheeler had addressed those specific concerns, or if the DA was in a better position to serve that need now than it was last year. All the DA was really willing to say was that they prioritize supervision and treatment over incarceration when possible, and that their ability to divert people to housing or services is entirely dependent on what is available in the county at that time.
Well, there's certainly a lot to be said about this camping ban and the legalese that it employs, but I want to take it back to the people who are impacted by this, right? Which you do a great job of in the piece as well. Some 5,000 Multnomah County residents are sleeping on the streets each night without a shelter open to them. And of course, the core, the crux of the issue of this camping ban is the criminalization. What role does that threat play for folks outside?
Yeah, I mean, to your point, like, the shelters that the city and county currently fund, there's less than 2,700 beds. And we're talking about, in total, over 11,000 people on the streets. And those shelters are generally quite full. And we still have over 5,000 who are unsheltered. I mean, as far as criminalizing, you know, public sleeping, just in general, the statistics, I mean, it's just a very well accepted fact that arresting people for being homeless, not only does that not help them become not homeless, but it actually increases the duration that people experience homelessness. It increases the chances of people, you know, returning to homelessness. Even arresting people who are not homeless increases the chance that they will end up homeless at some point. You know, it's such a well-established connection that even the federal government recognizes it in referring to the jail to homelessness pipeline. You know, it's just something that I think on its face doesn't make a whole lot of sense. The idea that you're going to arrest people and potentially subject them to criminal charges, that somehow that will help them get off the streets. And right now, I mean, in Portland, roughly 50% of all people arrested are homeless people already, right? And that's a population that represents somewhere around 2% of the total population in the city. So, I mean, it's part of this objectively defies logic, right? Like, just factually speaking, arresting people not only does not help them get into housing, it furthers them from that stability. And, you know, I mean, I think, again, 50% of all arrests, despite being about 2% of the population, go walk around downtown. I mean, if you want evidence for how this approach works practically, go walk around downtown. I mean, there's just nothing here that suggests arresting, jailing, fining people who already don't have money, already don't have a place to live, is somehow going to get them off the streets. It's a punishment.
What do you hope readers and listeners get from this piece?
Well, I mean, I think something that is really important just in this broader debate is the introduction of some facts. You know, I think that whether it's press coverage or conversations that people have between themselves, there are a lot more opinions going around than actual facts, actual statistics, expert opinions, case studies. You know, there are, I think, a lot of things that have been proven that should be part of these conversations that aren't getting brought up. So, you know, I hope it encourages people, because regardless of whether or not people are mad at homeless people or don't like homeless people or are scared of them or whatever the case may be, somebody, you know, it's their prerogative if they think homeless people should be arrested in Portland for being homeless, right? What is not up for debate is whether or not that has ever been a successful way of addressing homelessness. And I mean, all the data shows that it's not. In fact, it makes things worse.
Where can folks find a copy for themselves?
Go out and find a vendor in your neighborhood. If you cannot locate a vendor, all of our stories are free to read at streetroots.org.
Do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yes, I guess. Go grab a paper. We have another really excellent story this week about rapid response BioClean. So I think which is a private contractor the city pays to sweep homeless encampments. So if you want to know more, I guess, about kind of enforcement that takes place around homelessness, that is a very good story to read if you want a better understanding of that.
Well, Kay, thank you so much for talking with me today. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
That was Kay Rambo, editor-in-chief at Street Roots, speaking with me about their latest story. It's called If at First You Don't Succeed. City Council passes amended law seeking to jail and fine homeless Portlanders after a court injunction halted 2023 version. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
This is Ursula K. Le Guin, and you are listening to KBOO, the cheerful voice of social conscience, KBOO, Portland.